You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Juan Carlos is the director of the Nexus Center for Internet and Society at the Politecnico di Torino and one of our close collaborators here at Berkman. Him and Charlie. Charlie is the founder of the Berkman Center and a faculty co-director and also a professor of law here. They're here to talk to us about rethinking university's role in the network age. So welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm here to turn it immediately over to Juan Carlos.
No, thank you. Too kind. First of all, a short preamble. Many of you remember that about 1 year ago, the Berkman Center, the Nexus Center, organized this conference in Torino at the end of June, so almost 1 year ago, on university and cyberspace with a very similar topic to the title of this talk today, Reshaping Knowledge Institutions for the Networked Age. We worked for almost 1 year before the conference took place. Then the 3 days happened with many, many wonderful speakers and ideas. And since then, with Charlie, we've been thinking about the legacy of that conference because it was obvious that it was fun. Everybody who attended it thought it was a great conference, but we had the idea that it was just an initial starting point where many ideas were tossed around by architects, by engineers, computer scientists, law professors, librarians, but somehow a synthesis was missing. Well, I'm not presenting a synthesis because I realize that it's extremely difficult. I'm just presenting, sharing with you my draft, our draft point of reflection after almost 1 year. The focus of the conference was university and cyberspace. So after 1 year, what happened to me and Charles is that sure, we are interested in university and cyberspace, but the first term, university, turned out for an ignorant computer engineering professor like me much more challenging and difficult than at first I thought. At the beginning, I thought the university was something simple. University, yes, we all know what's the university, what's the purpose of university. But then I started digging, and with Charlie, we created an outline of a book. And in the beginning, we say, yeah, university, this, you know, we know what the university is for. And then started digging, and I realized that very soon I had got myself into very difficult waters because university is a very complex concept. It's far from being univocal. It's far from being one thing. University is many things. So I ended up problematizing it, if you want. I ended up also using a different metaphor of a wonderful Italian book, Pinocchio by Collodi. I ended up, that's Pinocchio, the little black figure here is Pinocchio about to be swallowed by the whale, actually by the big fish, and I ended up in the big fish. I mean, still there. So what I'm trying to do today is just to discuss with you what I'm finding inside the fish before it gets hopefully spit out at some point. So why are we talking of university? We're talking of university when a concept is being problematized is because there is a crisis of some sort. Up to that point, when a concept like democracy or many other concepts are not discussed, is because everybody takes them for granted that there's nothing to be discussed. So it's a crisis in the sense of both challenges, both long-term and short-term challenges, as well as opportunities. We started with the opportunities. We started with university in cyberspace, seeing university in cyberspace mostly as an opportunity. But there are also several challenges. And please apologize. I apologize for the fact that, of course, my talk is going to be a little EU-slanted because we have specific situations and specific problems in Europe. But I think that the general concepts and general questions and answers have a global validity, I hope. So we're at a moment where, actually it happened already decades ago, something that was implicit struggles to become explicit. Actually, now you can say there is an industry of books on university, of articles on university, at least from the late 80s, if not before. For instance, this is just a recent example from the New York Review of Books, a review of four recent books on university. And if you read this article, like many other similar articles, you find how large is this bibliography, the contributions on the role of university. And as you can see from the titles, some of them are similar to the title of the conference and the title of this talk. So what are universities for? What I detected is that there is an overlap of processes, historical processes, long-term processes that are interacting with political processes. I'm thinking particularly of the EU, but probably something similar in the United States is happening. Cultural processes, technological processes. Again, we started from there, from the technology, from cyberspace. But then I clearly discovered and made more clear the other longer-term, more complex processes. Just a quick recap, and there are historians in this room, so please close your eyes and close your ears. The early university, my takeaway points is the early university starts in the 11th century taking books out of the monastery to make them public, so to discuss them in public, to teach them in public, particularly to read them in public. Because that's the meaning of the word lecture or college, to read them in public. So just a few points. We're talking about the Middle Ages, so there is a clear guild-like mentality and guild-like organization. When you talk about universitas magistrorum et scholarium, you talk about magistrorum, masters of a guild, not yet professors. We'll come back to professors later on. It's in some places students hire professors and pay them directly. It's a time where there is a truly European university space, so you get the license to teach. You can teach anywhere in Europe. And the last point is the one that it will be recurring and is still recurring to this day, a constant struggle with powers, both religious and lay powers, about the autonomy of the universities, the privileges of universities, the physical location of universities, many aspects of university, a constant struggle, which in Italy, my country, is deeply influenced by, for instance, by the Pope and by the Church. But I want to skip, also because it's not my calling to be an historian, to go straight to the modern university. And I will only take two ways of defining the modern university. The first one, which is already also in the title of the talk, is Wilhelm von Humboldt Principles. In 1810, he wrote a memorandum setting out a vision, a master plan, a blueprint for a university that soon after that was to become the Berlin University, University of Berlin. And the three pillars of this university that was starting at the beginning of the 19th century was the unity of research and teaching that now we take for granted, which was not at the time, freedom of teaching, so what we call now academic freedom, and academic self-governance. So the struggle with the powers that lasted for many centuries, Humboldt says the university has to be able to self-rule, to self-govern itself. Another vision from the Anglo-Saxon world is John Henry Newman. And in his An Idea of a University in 1852, he describes something that looks quite familiar, I think, particularly in a place like Harvard. A university is a place where students come from every quarter for every kind of knowledge, a place for the communication and circulation of thought by means of personal intercourse. It is the place to which 1,000 schools make contributions, in which the intellect may safely range and speculate. It is a place where inquiry is pushed forward, discovery is verified and perfected, and error exposed by the collision of mind with mind and knowledge with knowledge. Mutual education, in the large sense of the word, is one of the great and incessant occupations of human society. One generation forms another. We must consult the living man and listen to his living voice by familiar intercourse to adjust together the claims and relations of their respective subjects of investigations. Thus is created a pure and clear atmosphere of thought which the student also breathes. It's so dense and packed with concepts, and is a pretty clear and exhaustive description of the modern university. and you're very familiar with this. The paradigmatic moment of the modern university is the lecture, or could be the lecture. In my choice is the lecture, the moment where a professor, somebody who profess, and I'll come back to that, takes a printed book, not his lectures, not his copy, manuscript notes taken by students. He takes a printed book, and in public, he puts it on the table, figuratively speaking, and his students, who already read the book or are reading the book, discuss with him and try to understand and discuss it and explore its meaning. We could say that this modern university that was born at the beginning of the 19th century was a remarkable worldwide success. It's a model that has been imitated all over the world. Maybe it's not the only model, but definitely is the reference model. However, this Humboldtian university, this modern university, since it betrays the fact that it was started at the start of the 19th century, because it was seen as a key institution of the nation state. It was there to define a cultural, a national culture, maybe in some cases a national language, to define it, to expand it, to strengthen it. In this regard, it is an institution of the state. The objective was to form experts leading the nation towards progress. Not many or not at all other venues to create knowledge outside this university. And by definition was forming an elite. So a tiny percentage of population, typically the ruling class, would go to the university to be formed and to become the new elite. Now, time goes by and we have a weakening of the states. They are not gone by all means, but a weakening of the states, and in the case of Europe, the creation of a supranational entity like the European Union. Knowledge is obviously created also outside universities. It's not a monopoly anymore. And the most important of all, arguably, mass education. No more an elite, but we have a large percentage of the population going to university. Now, it's based on this, it's obvious, has been said many times before, that the Humboldtian model is clearly in need of an adjustment, of a new model, or at least a post-Humboldtian model, which at the very least has to be democratic and has to be a world university. So the university speaking to the world and having connections and living in a world space rather than a nation state space. Now, this is, we could say it's an historic trend that has been going on for the last at least two or three generations. Now, I was telling you that there are also political processes, technological processes. Let's start with a political process. Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of the UK, in the 80s, by a fairly obscure decision, starts to put UK universities under the review or under the accountability of an administrative office of the UK government. And that triggers a series of consequences. The key word is accountability. You're given freedom because universities have a large degree of freedom, but you need to be accountable for it. So that I put it in quotes because accountability is a treacherous concept. You see a review of what happens since the 80s in this, again, an article of the New York Review of Books by Simon Head, as this apparently administrative way of saying, okay, you're going to get the money from the UK government, provided that you give us some metrics and you provided that you explain us that they're using the money wisely, has deep implications in the way universities function in the UK, but not only in the UK, because this started in the UK in the 80s, but in the 90s, and then at the beginning of this century, this parlance of accountability and control based on metrics has become the de facto standard in the European Union, including in my country. So started there, but then became mainstream. The second thing that happened shortly after that is that at the end of the 80s, the Berlin Wall came down. And with that, one of the consequences was that Each country felt itself in a competition with all other countries. It was an economic competition, by and large. So a strong emphasis on competition, economic growth, short-term immediate results, innovation. Innovation is one of the keywords and the buzzwords. Apply to universities, meaning that we expect innovation directly from you and come reaching sometimes the point of we expect essentially you to provide the products, not just provide the environment in which innovation grows, and a strong emphasis on science and technology, because we think, governments think, that science and technology is where the economic return is faster and more evident. So as I was saying, accountability. This economic competition frame of mind extremely strong, unquestioned in most cases, became the word of the day. And it was clear, it is becoming clear, not only in the UK, but elsewhere, that this is becoming more and more controlled. And I'm not the only one saying that. The League of European Research Universities, that I will quote in a second, they are saying as much. Metrics. The way things are done, this sort of accountability control is through metrics, meaning that government offices are continuously producing grids and spreadsheets with an increasing number of parameters that are used to determine whether a university is good, a department is good, and a single individual researcher is good. So they're trying not, it's difficult, they're not looking at the actual outcome, how good are my students, or how really good is my research. They are trying to use numbers to determine that. I told you that I was going to quote the League of European Research Universities. There is a wonderful essay that they wrote in 2008, What Are Universities For? It is vital to understand that such mechanism can ultimately undermine the outcomes that are a university's principal benefit to society. They can end up essentially destroying what they're trying in principle to strengthen. Now, so historical, political, technological, university and cyberspace, which was our main focus since 2009, then the conference that I mentioned to you. It's obvious, amazing opportunities, thanks to the internet. But the question quickly becomes, what changes, what could be made different, and but also what stays the same? What do we want to keep as it is, because it's working just fine as it is? So the question, what university in a network age? I mentioned straight away something that is obvious, a clear opportunity that is already happening to an amazing scale, online learning. A clear opportunity to span the reach of universities on the plane coming from to here from Europe. The Herald Tribune had a full page on online learning. Long distance degrees come of age in Asia. And they talk about all the people that in remote areas can access an education, sometimes even at the doctoral level, without needing to move to a big city. And we're talking of millions of students that can profit from that. And of course, it's something that has to be done properly, but it's positive. But the funny thing is, not only in Asia, the same page also said German universities have a crisis of crowding. In Italy, because of government's policy, university students are decreasing. But in other more enlightened country like in Germany, actually, the number of students is increasing quite dramatically. So distance learning, they look at distance learning also to handle this crisis of success. But not everything should change, though. When we met last year in Turin, the idea was, should you start from scratch? Would you build a library? Would you build actual physical buildings? Would it be completely online? And I argue that no, that something is very valuable as it is, being physically together in the same place. I just mentioned, Yochai is not here, I think. I just mentioned that in his paper that I recently discovered by Yochai Benkler, he argues the same, that some things will remain the same because they have very good reasons to remain the same. Other things will change. What I tried to sum up is, and I'll come back to this slide, is that, and this is sort of the end of my objective, is that we are going to have also in the future something we could call the experience, and forget for the X, the missing X, experience, meaning being physically in one place, and I'll come back to this. The real, up to now, only the inner circle was possible. We had to be physically in one place. The inner circle remains there for the lucky few who will be able to have that experience, but it's enlarged. It's enlarged by technology to also have an online experience, meaning that even the people physically in a place, they're also enjoying a virtual university. They can be physically on Harvard campus, at the same time also have an online experience. They already do on Facebook, on social networks. But that, so there will be an extension of the physical experience. There already is, and it will be enriched and changed over time. And also this online experience is also, we could think that the online experience is the one that people doing distance learning are having. They're not having the experience in the red circle, but they're having a university experience online. And then the larger circle is what the university contributes to the commons or to the public domain. I use the words open access because I didn't have much space to write, but open access means the publications, the educational materials, the software, the data, everything that the university just places out there without providing an actual education is out there and is feeding the commons, and it will be used in all sorts of predictable and unpredictable ways. Now, going over this past 6 months and reading about this treacherous idea of university, at some point I very happily discovered that the League of European Research Universities emphasized not only education and research, but also public engagement, something that when we had the conference in Torino, we had if you remember, you had the research, we had education, then we say, let's be bold, let's talk about the civic role of university. And I thought of being particularly original. Of course, there was nothing original, but I'm glad that public engagement, both of the single professors, individual professors, and the institution, is becoming more important. And correctly, the League of European Research Universities also see the international level of this public engagement. If we have to cope with problems like the climate change, the network of universities that share a similar ethos worldwide have a very clear potential of doing something effective. But from the public engagement, I ended up stumbling into another complex and slippery and powerful concept, which is parresia. Parresia, you could connect it with, I'll talk extensively about this, because it's maybe the single strongest idea that I want to contribute to this attempt to define a university for this new century. Parresia means to speak freely and to speak the truth, literally. Before explaining more specifically what parresia means for the ancient Greeks, I just make a quotation to explain how important was parresia for the ancient Greeks. And I do that quoting Foucault, who quotes the Phoenician, I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce these names in English, but Le Fenici by Euripides. This is a quotation between Jocasta and Polynice. And it says, she asks him, what is it to be an exile, to be away from your country? And he says, it's very hard to bear. What is it like? One thing most of all, the exile cannot speak his mind. So it's a slave. It's like being a slave to refrain from uttering from what one thinks. The follies of his rulers must be bare. That too is bitter, to join in the folly of fools. Okay, for them, being an exile, the greatest pain was, I cannot speak my mind, which the technical term used by the Greek was, I cannot be a parisast, I cannot do parisia. Saying frankly, all you have in mind in the most the simplest possible way so that people can fully and exactly understand what you mean. So a few, it's a concept that has been quite well defined. It's a relationship between the speaker and what is being said, meaning I'm just not informing you. I'm telling you that this is my personal opinion. I'm putting myself at stake. Second point is that paresia implies danger. Means if there is no danger of any sort, it's not paresia. What does it mean? It means that I'm speaking frankly my mind and I run some risk. In the extreme case, I'm running my life because I'm telling the truth to a tyrant. But in other cases, it might simply be that people in high places will not like me, they will not give me some nice plush job, or I will lose some money, I will not get up for promotion. So some sort of danger. The parias is someone who chooses a specific relationship with him or herself. He prefers to be the one who speaks truth rather than being a human being false with himself. So it's a specific choice. In fact, it's a choice. So nobody is forcing the person speaking frankly to speak frankly. It's a choice. But at the same time, the way it does that is because of a sense of duty. I do that because of the well-being of my democracy, of my country, the well-being of the people, the well-being of a friend. Parisia can also be with a friend. I tell a friend frankly what I think for his own good, even though I run the risk that the friend will not be a friend anymore. The specific quotation by Foucault is, with Parisia, the speaker uses his liberty and chooses to speak frankly instead of persuasion, truth rather than falsity or silence, the risk of dying rather than life and safety, criticism rather than adulation, moral duty rather than his personal interest or moral apathy. So obviously, parisia is the leading idea for democracy, at least in the sense that the ancient Greeks had. The ethical is the ethical and personal attitude of the good citizen. Now, the connection with university is in this word, in to profess. Recently, I had the pleasure of introducing Larry Lessig in Torino during a festival we had, the Biennale Democrazia, and in his official bio, he says, "I profess law at Harvard Law School." I profess. To profess, also Cicero says, I profess grammatic, is to frankly declare what one is, what one believes, what one wants to be, to publicly promise to care, to devote oneself, to witness one's disciple, to fight for her. To profess, therefore, is to go beyond purely informative talk, transfer of information. I teach engineering, and believe me, the typical metaphor we have in my school, like many other places, is, well, we just need to efficiently transfer bits of information from my head to their head. It goes beyond purely informative talk. It's a public commitment. So in this sense, and this is the connection that I want to make, and it's not by all means original, it's just that I've been struck by it, and I want to share it with you. The professor is a parisiast, somebody who does parisia, as otherwise is not a professor. And also, the professor is an amateur, so somebody who does that because of the love of what he, of the discipline of what he wants to share with the students or with colleagues or with the public at large. So another way of saying that is that the university, the professor and the university, this could be a place where matters of concern are made public and shared, first of all, with the students and then with the larger public. And that can be done, must be done, both in person, because in person you have a physical connection with the speakers that works also at an emotional level that is extremely important. It goes back to the red circle, the experience. If I do it in person and I put myself at stake, you can get all sorts of also non-verbal messages about my person. all my life, in principle, is at stake, and online. So I can also speak truth with a blog. I can do it with distance learning. It's different. You lose some kind of information, but still, it's important. So in summary, if we go back to this slide, then the proposal could be, and then I'll give space for the discussion starting from Charlie. The experience, and so this university for this century, and of course it, in part what I'm describing is already happening and has been happening, so it's nothing. I'm not saying we should start something that never happened. Parisia has been happening within this campus for centuries. But what I'm saying is that conceptualizing it as the crucial feature that university and professors and students must have, particularly in this time of age and with such difficult global problems to face, but using the internet to extend it both with the online experience and more broadly with the contribution of university to the public domain as explored in the conference in Torino. Thanks.
Well, I had three reactions. The first is Parisia. I keep hearing, when you say Parisia, I keep hearing poker. The idea that when you describe Parisia, it sounds to me like you're just describing a loose poker player instead of a tight poker player. It's like, you're not really saying, you know, damn the risk, I don't care whether I get killed, I'm going to put myself in the face of authority and all. Mm-hmm. That's not Parisia. Mm-hmm. Parisia is somebody who's like cool at the point of interface and figures out which way to go. So it's I love the idea of truth. That's what Harvard is, Veritas. And the idea of studying truth by exploring this opportunity to switch sides on that interface. I think so Parisian poker, that was the first reaction. Second reaction is I've come to be very skeptical of online education in so many ways. To me, where I came from the conference was more towards trying to focus what I meant by university. And I've come to think that what I mean by university is coincident with the public domain. Mm-hmm. It's like cyberspace. Cyberspace is all the bits that you can reach in the digital environment. And the idea of creation, the idea of generativity, so that there's more and more, that's a process that is, in its way, it's at the other end of the extension that you started with the idea of reading to the public, the book to the public. All right. University, in a sense, now can serve this public domain in a way we could never do it before. And most specifically, for me, it's come down to, well, how do you actually build it? And I'm at the moment infused with the thought that the idea of law and property in a digital environment makes no sense without a digital registry, any more than real property makes sense without a real registry. And that the place to start in building a registry is with the public domain, where the rights are the clearest. You can actually get clear identification of public domain. And when you look to universities to see what their deepest assets are, they are their oldest, most precious heritage of wherever they represent. So the idea of actually engaging in the building of a registry of the public domain has come to kind of focus for me the idea of university. The university is the universal cyberspace that you can reach for free. That is the university. That is the library. And So that's good enough. I don't need number three. Dorothy. Dorothy's in Berg.
Hi. Thank you very much for expanding our thinking about this. Charlie's on poker. I thought of Weber. That this very interesting presentation is an idealistic type, I believe, of what the university is. So I thought I'd give you three factoids, a null hypothesis, and a cross-cutting variable to help analyze some of this. The three factoids are the von Humboldt model never worked. I was a visiting fellow at the von Humboldt Institute, and what Germany has never been able to do is bring together research and teaching, so they have a Max Planck Institute where all of the research is done and everything else gets done in the universities, and they're not very good universities. That's number one. Number two, Mrs. Thatcher. If you look at the notion of accountability, her hostility to universities stemmed from the fact that Oxford voted against giving her an honorary degree. And if you look at that as background, you can see everything that developed in England based on her antipathy to the universities. I think I'll leave out the third one and leap to the null hypothesis, which was Bill Gates saying in 20 years there will be no more universities, so you can really get to work on that. But the cross-cutting variable is what I see both in Germany and in England, and the wild diversity in the United States. When we talk about universities in this conversation, that's Harvard. But there are 3,200 other universities which bear no relationship to this discussion. And I think that what is very helpful is to go back and look at the technical stream. For example, when all the technology institutes in England became universities, that changed everything because they don't really do research yet. They're competing for research funds. It was the best social mobility available in England come through those technical universities. And that's where I think some of the work that you and Charlie are doing could really benefit, to see where does distance learning fit into the lives of people who are not interested in this experience, who are going to get the degree to be an X, which is very, very different. And I think in the United States, the same thing. It's such a diverse population, it would be very helpful to break it down and see where the technology fits in. Charlie, would you feel it's better to have no education than distance learning?
No, I just have found that the forms that the distance learning takes are so driven by selling certificates that it's corrupted it. So, I mean, I'm a total fan of distance learning, but the way I've been trying to do it, for example, is to have my students engaging a distant class through the net in some way that has everybody excited. But
that's
not
very different.
Yes, it's not the lecture.
I'm going to finish. The other thing is the social experience. That in the 60s at Harvard, if you talked about education, it was referred to as a moratorium. It was that period between being an adolescent and a young adult, and 4 years out gave you a chance to grow in a social, psychological fashion in a protected environment. Nobody talks about that anymore, and that's a very different function from what we had then. And now it's, you can see by the figures of how many people are taking economics as opposed to social psychology.
That was the main theme of the Turin Conference.
Oh, really?
That was the number one message that came out, that at the core, a university is a gathering.
Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have that, then we're talking about something quite different. Yeah. And very few people have that relative to what we're seeing now in education.
Yeah. Harry.
Oh, my goodness. You have said, it's got me so many things. I mean, I when Dorothy said it was idealistic, I
almost puked.
Yes. I mean, because I was thinking of the idealism in the university, which is Parisia, which you were so beautifully articulated, and how little of that there is. That,
exactly.
You know, I'm just...
Oh, I said just, ideal typical type. Not idealistic.
Yeah, ideal, typical type. Let me gather my thoughts for a moment. I've got a bunch of them floating around.
All right, wide open, yes.
Just a thought about the concerns made public. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole question of, or the whole comment of ivory tower. Mm-hmm. And so I keep thinking about how ideas can get deployed out to make the public concerned about what the researchers are concerned about, so i.e. climate change. How do you get a whole citizenship engaged and mobilized into effective action from the ideas that are being nurtured and discovered within the university? I think there can be a real disconnect. And I think that that's, in my mind, some of the challenge and creativity in taking the ideas that are discovered and helping citizenship become more active.
Right.
Mr. Abruzzi.
So when you were talking about Parigi, I was thinking about tenure. And how it's often said,
is that something you've been thinking about generally?
No, it just happened to click. That's the entire sort of underpinning for tenure, at least as it's been expressed, is that it enables faculty members to speak their minds, at least within the university, without fear of at least the ultimate repercussion. And I think as we talk about graduating Parigi outside the university gates into those larger ovals that you showed us, I wonder what similar institution is required to help sort of mediate between the faculty member and the state. I mean, we find now that yes, you're secure at your university, but if we don't particularly like the shape of your hockey stick chart, then the Virginia Attorney General could come after you. And there are all sorts of, I think, sort of creeping. I see this as an attorney for a university. There's a lot of sort of creeping threats from the state, between the state and the university, in a way that I think either counsels in favor of containing ourselves within the ivory tower that we talked about, or at least thinking about how we might empower the university to really participate in public affairs in a Parigiastic way. And I wondered if you guys have any thoughts about how we could get there, because it doesn't seem like the academic freedom protections that we have now are as robust as maybe they ought to be.
Well, for me, it goes back to the kind of transition that you saw the New York Times make between conservative legal counsel and more aggressive legal counsel when the Pentagon Papers crisis hit. When Harvard, when a university comes to see that its interest is not merely in defending itself, but in actually moving forward, it changes an attitude. And it's, again, it's a question of how the administration plays the game. It's a deep subject. Now, Bob Darnton, I hadn't seen him, and then I got away from him, and I, hello, Bob, and please, what, please.
Well, actually, strange as it sounds, I thought of tenure, too, but as a problem, and it's something that I think, in a way, goes against Parigi, although it protects it. It makes possible bold, free, frank speech. But in practice, so much of life within the university is involved in getting the PhD as a kind of union card and making a career, building up a CV, publishing, not perishing, getting tenure and being protected. I mean, this is the opposite of the kind of advocacy which you, I think, are rightly describing. Now, Mrs. Thatcher also did away with tenure, and the research assessment exercise as practiced in England is taking British universities to an extreme state, as you described, of counting pages, building up CVs, trying to get more money. All of that is leading the university in the opposite direction from this kind of civic engagement that you are describing. So it's a global talk. Here's a global question. What can we do about this tendency? We can't say to our students, don't build up your CV, take more chances, don't worry about tenure. That's, we live in a real world. So what can we do? Well, I think, just for starters, but I put the question to you, is there some way in which we can use the technology to modify the rules of the game, such as not publishing the traditional monograph, which in many ways is dying, but publishing in the old sense of to render public research on the internet, open access, having our libraries publish all dissertations, open access, and somehow persuading tenure committees that the traditional monograph or collection of articles of its economics and philosophy is not the way to assess. Now, I don't think we'll ever persuade the British government that the research assessment exercise, which I think was actually unfairly described in that article in the New York Review of Books, but that's another issue. I don't think we can change things that way, but how can we inject more of this paresia into a system which is becoming self-serving in many respects?
Okay, now I've got my thoughts.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Bob, because I now remember, I got so distracted by Dorothy's comment that I lost track of the thing that really struck me, but which was
is
the
good or bad?
No. Was a statement of that the professor is amateur, and that was such an interesting observation because the premise of the Reisman Jenks academic revolution was the professionalization of the academic, and it actually leads to the narrowing of civic responsibility because we are beholden not just to the professional guild of professors, but the professional guild of professors of computer science, because they're the ones from whom we actually get our incentive and reward structure in the hyper specialized world of academic scholarship. So I don't get the unless it's another one of these unfulfilled ideals, which I think is a fine thing, but we need some change to the, not just to, state authority and all of that kind of thing, but to the actual, speaking to your third Humboldtian point, our academic self-governance, that the incentive and reward structure has to be changed if the faculty are going to see civic responsibility as part of their jobs, as opposed to, teaching and publishing in computer science, just to take a modest example here.
Yes, sir.
So thank you very much for your talk, which I appreciated very much, and the ideas are very common to some of the research we're doing in Belgium. But one of the points...
Yes, I didn't quote them, but Martin, Simons,
Maschlein...
I recognize
Maschlein, so many
of
the ideas.
Yes, absolutely.
But so one of the suggestions I would like to make is that, so when you speak about the network age, it is very focused on the physical network, which is the but I think we could broaden it a little bit to the whole society, and the effects on the university, and I'm thinking in terms of the disciplines at the university, and to take your examples, in the medieval university, it was a hierarchy, and in the second year, everybody had philosophy, which means mathematics and physics. And then after 150 years with the Renaissance, we came the pillar system or the silo system, and which is basically university now. And what we see is that we move into a web structure, and I think you are an example yourself, because as an engineer, you have to get into the history of universities in order to see what is going on. And so this will have an enormous effect, not only on the fact that we are sitting in our office and then linking to the world, but how we will build new buildings where the disciplines maybe are not completely broken, but at least come together in another way. Mm-hmm. And I think that is also an effect on this whole network university that is broader than only the physical network.
Absolutely. So, one thing that I was surprised not to hear more about was how this affects the students.
I mean, and namely, how would, you know, how would, in fact, these distant learning, these sharing, you know, affect the knowledge that the students gain, the students who are closer by enrolling, paying to enroll, versus those who are accessing the information, I guess, in a more open commons way. Furthermore, what I was especially interested to know more about is, like, the way that the professor can best, you know, communicate that information. Again, we have the lecture, the time-honored lecture, but I am, you know, in my undergraduate career, I was surprised at this hypermedia age. We still have talking on the blackboard. We still have, you know, doing problems, you know, doing work problems on our own in the evenings. Why are we not using this hypermedia to really kind of turn the entire way of educational information and communication on its head, to be working in these more, you know, to be working with these machines to communicate information in altogether new ways, and seeing how those affects those who work together in person versus those over the internet. Any thoughts on that?
We start to reply to at least some of the questions.
Well, let's just continue it out a little bit more, and then we'll do the replies if we may. Shoot.
I think that you mentioned, I mean, I also came from Spain, and I'm also from computer science. I think that one of the problems that you mentioned is that you are not judged by the output. Mm-hmm. And so here I think that we are probably not fully considering if students are learning more or less. Mm-hmm. Probably in some cases just taking out the professor and putting some contents. Mm-hmm. In some cases, maybe we will be surprised. Mm-hmm. This is one of the issues. I think that changed the situation, and probably we are not very happy, because we already have our tenure. We already know what the university was when we entered it, and now it's changing. So probably this is one of the things. Another thing is my university is a Complutense University, has more than five centuries. And what's happened when there is a title that is given by my university, for instance, in law, and it is no way to distinguish if that title was obtained in a presential class or was obtained in a distance mode. I think it's a completely new situation where that is much more diverse. I'm talking about, of course, they are new medium, they are new material that could be much more interactive. And what's happened when you need to focus on the output and not on the way to obtain this? Because that's happening now in my university. It was a very old university, then you install a new virtual campus, and the law faculty that was initially the more reluctant, they became, I mean, really engaged, and they decided to go for one of their classes to go fully virtually. But not being able to distinguish this student from the rest of the students, what's happened there? Hmm. But there's not anymore just online universities and presential universities, or even blended learning, where you provide support to your student for improving learning. But what's happened with there is a continuum? Yes, to put more ideas.
Yeah. I know Harry sits on the, I guess it's the visiting committee or something to our extension school, where you get exactly that, this mix of online and present students and opportunities to make comparisons and really experiment. So it is extremely interesting. So let me just continue and get everybody in, and then we'll talk a little bit. Yes.
One thing I've been wondering about when listening to your talk is how can this process of rethinking the university actually take place? Because there seems to be this peculiar relationship between what we think about and how we think about it, obviously, but we often brush over it, right? So, and in a sense, when I was listening to your talk, the way you talk about it is in terms of lots of grandiose concepts of society, network age, the university. So, and then this made me think other ways of usefully joining this process, which have not to do this rather, I would say, Humboldtian approach of thinking about rethinking the university, but maybe there's other ways, and this may be something that takes place on the in the field on the side of research itself, for instance, by doing more ethnographic studies, for instance, we're talking in terms of methods, but also in terms of broader participation, because after all, this is another small room here with professors and those who are seeking tenure and so on are joining the discussion. So it's, in a sense, again, it's replicating this process. So how can we break through this possibly and rethink university in the way we would like it to be?
All right, go. Then we talk.
thinking about Harvard in particular, I think a bit about the relationship of Harvard to the American empire and just wonder if we talk about civic engagement or a duty to the world at large, we must, you know, question that empire and its effects. But if we're getting money from the government, then, and if we peg our existence to serving the public interest, when that public interest is defined by government dollars, I mean, the government's not going to want to fund people who are going against what its stated interests are. So how do you imagine, and the reverse, having universities for pay or a more for-profit structure, of course, then that limits it, doesn't make it democratic anymore. So how do you reconcile this idea you have with the university with the realities of funding and especially the resilience of the nation state and of nationalism that still controls funding?
Maybe I can start from the last one. And of course, I cannot provide feedback to all the wonderful questions and comments you made, but just a selected few ones. I was reading this book about free speech by Bollinger on free speech in the 21st century, and I was one page really struck me because it resonated a lot with what's going on in my country. My country, you know, it's a weak democracy, although the wonderful election results of yesterday give some hope. But Bollinger was explaining what happened with PBS in the early 70s. Forgive me if I say something not completely precise, but early 70s, PBS was recently created. It works with government money directly. There is not a special fee like in BBC, like in UK with BBC fee, or in Italy with something similar for our public broadcasting. That means every year you need to get Congress to get money, to give you money, which is a pretty direct control. Yet the recently created PBS went after President Nixon, and with great strength and courage. And Bollinger gives why that happened. And he says three things. He said, well, first of all, the journalists there had a strong sense of their deontological institutional duty. So they felt they were an institution, and they act accordingly. Secondly, self-restraint on part of politicians. And third, finally, the court protecting free speech. These three components, in Italy we only have the third left, because journalists have a very weak sense of their role in society, and self-restraint by politicians is almost a joke. So we only have the courts left. The connection with your objection is that, fortunately, in democracies as strong as in the US, the relationship between government money and behavior is not that straightforward. You can get government money and yet not be completely compliant. In other countries, maybe that's less the case. Secondly, what can we do? Of course, open access is a way. We just launched our open access repository in my institution on Friday. I happen to be the dean of libraries. And this one way to argue for that was, if we do it, it's good for our the reputation of universities, too. We have been lynched on media by the Berlusconi government in order to prepare the ground for a reform law that was approved last December. But for 2 years, we were lazy. We were called barons, feudal barons, hiring our wives and lovers all over. So we were, for 2 years, we were absolutely attacked. And open access is a way of saying, look what we do, our publications, our teaching material. The second thing is what we're trying to do today. It's cultural in the sense that most colleagues, maybe I'm an engineering school, which is somewhat less active than other faculties, but most colleagues, they accept the frame of mind that we are essentially a company. It's okay to have metrics. We are like high-level functionaries, and we're just churning out papers and students, and they fundamentally don't really see what's the problem. So the reaction to that is only trying to be grandiose and to go back to the basic principles, to have a different narrative, starting for our colleagues and then going wider to the students and wider to the wider public, eventually reaching politics. I mean, the European Commission writes their communications and green papers and white papers, and we need also to reach that level. And it's first of all a cultural activity which becomes political eventually if you're successful. You were mentioning, yes, how to involve. Well, it's connected. First of all, we have to start with a closer circle and to shape a shared vision of what we believe in, and then we can go out. In Italy, after this reform law, the government has forced us to have new statutes in a time of 6 months. So in 6 months, we have, starting in January, we need to have new statutes. Otherwise, they send a commissar for the government, which means essentially there's no discussion whatsoever. Okay, essentially it's the director commissioning to a consultant agency outside a statute and then slipping it at the last moment and say, okay, this is the new statute. But it's like a new constitution, so to speak. It's going to last for the next 10 or 20 years. My humble reaction to that was I created a web platform copying a Harvard idea, Publius. I created a web platform where we accepted and solicited short essays on the model of the Federalist Papers on the future of university, on the statutes. We had like a dozen contributions from all over Italy, none from students, unfortunately. It's a tiny action, but it's the only kind of action that I can think of to involve a larger audience. I'm sure there are many other replies that I should give. Yeah, online.
Well, I just come back to
amateur. Amateur, just that. Amateur, not in the sense of imprecise or amateurish, in the sense of loving.
Yes, I understand. But
loving the discipline.
Yeah. Well, no, not loving discipline. Loving, because we all love our own disciplines, but that's not where maybe that is what you mean.
This is what you mean. I love philosophy. I love computer science. I love it. I care for my discipline.
But you don't carry a union card as a philosopher. You've taken on that mantle, but your union card says electrical engineer. That's what I mean.
Yes, and of course the system of incentives has to change to actually get many of the things we're discussing, the web of disciplines reconnecting together to face transversal horizontal problems. If you want to encourage actual civic participation, you have to change the system of incentives, changing the way review committees or tenure committees review the literature, open access or non-open access. So, of course, right now, you're being very realistic. You're very right. I'm perfectly aware of the incentives right now, and I'm pretty sure that for my community, this means less than zero. It's actually negative, the impact.
Well, let me offer what I think of as a Berkman Center perspective, okay? Miles Berkman, to whom we owe a great deal here, would always respond to the typical request for money. You've already got the money that you need. Just go ahead and do it. All right, now what I'm hearing is a lot of complaint about all the constraints on university that come from the accumulated barnacles of the past in the form that we're now oppressed by management structure and corporate thinking, and the Harvard Business School is taking over the you know, it's like, okay, it's like Reuben is running the country and so forth. It's like Harry's been onto this. But I come back to a talk that Larry Lessig gave basically 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, at the Rethink Music conference, where he, and I recommend this talk to you, it's like 5 minutes audio, Larry Lessig speaking without PowerPoint. I mean, it's like, and he stood up and was just impassioned, talking to a copyright audience about the problem not being conceptual. The problem was very practical. A contest between those who make money from the way it's been and those who will profit from the way it could be. And his point was that the people with the money are extremely powerful. I mean, the copyright industry represents a rhetorical crushing force, for example, and that's just there, okay? So money speaks through its rhetoric very powerfully. But his point was that to beat them, you have to move with stealth. It's not to focus on how tough they are. It's to figure out the stealth move that beats them. And the internet effectively offers tremendous opportunity. When you see WikiLeaks, when you see Wiki, when you see things that are capable of affirmative development, changing the nature of the problem. And, all right, well, just stop there. I mean, to me, what that means is that if university saw as its mission the expansion of the public domain, that is fulfilling this reading college thing, and even saw the science stuff it does within the theoretical framework that's supposedly offered, where, yes, you put it in patent, but 20 years later the public gets it, and yes, you put it in copyright, but for limited times, even though we know it's a joke. But the idea that that would actually be seen as an informing mission of university against which other things might be judged, and in the process, in some way, pulling it off to a point where its own power starts to shift the ways in which people think about what's valuable in the process. That to me, is where I've been coming. So thank you so much
for coming.
This has been a wonderful discussion. Thank you all for participating. And
thank you.
I guess we call it to a close.